Okay. So, there are many questions about how to understand natural selection in variable environments, at least to me. And this summary slide attempts to sort of classify those questions. One can try to talk about understanding natural selection in temporal versus spatial variation. One must take into account, especially for sexual organisms, whether selection is acting within versus between, or if environmental variation exists within versus between generations. One can also talk or discuss how environmental variation is defined to be continuous or discrete. And variable also needs to be better defined as a rate of environmental change in a particular environmental factor versus environmental fluctuations. Then we sort of question all of this, taking into account the organism that we are focusing on, and we get to questions of what's the actual dimensionality of the environment, and we get to concepts such as information and what's the reliability of the cues that organisms or individuals can perceive. And then there are very different population genetic dynamics, whether we consider evolution simply by mutation accumulation, or from pre-existing genetic diversity, or from more broadly from standing genetic variation. And I'll go a little bit into what I mean by this.
I think you're going to say this now. What is the difference between the last two?
So pre-existing genetic diversity, I consider simply basically an additive model in which you have competing genotypes that are unable to create new recombinant or segregants during evolution, while standing genetic variation includes not only these, but potential selection for new segregants or new recombinants. So I've been mostly been working with the nematode C. neuroditis elegans, and so I introduce it to you a little bit of its biology. It's an androdioecious nematode that eats bacteria. It has evolved androdioecy from an ancestral state of dioecy. For those of you who don't know what this means, this is simply that there are males and females and that they outcross with each other. Androdioecious, it means that a particular population is composed both of hermaphrodites and of males. Hermaphrodites of C. elegans can only mate with males. So it's analogous to pollen discounting, complete pollen discounting in angiosperms. And this has the advantage that we can actually quantify the degree of selfing versus outcrossing simply by counting males, and with very little assumptions. Developmentally, hermaphrodites are protandous, meaning that spermatogenesis is followed by oogenesis, and they cannot go back to producing more sperm. And so under most demographic conditions, hermaphrodites are actually self-sperm limited, which is not usual for animals or plants. In terms of genetics, sex determination is chromosomal, with males aneuploid for the X chromosome and hermaphrodites diploid. In nature, it's thought that this species predominantly selfs in quite ephemeral environments, giving rise to these boom and boost dynamics in a metapopulation kind of structure. And then the genome is 100 megabases in size. In terms of diversity for single nucleotide polymorphisms, it's very poor, about one SNP every kb. We don't know about other kinds of polymorphisms. And in nature, it appears that there have been recent almost whole genome sweeps of beneficial mutants and extensive background selection. This cartoon over here shows the physical position relative to the genetic position obtained from two particular crosses between two particular inbred lines. And as you can see, it's non-linear for all the chromosomes, with what we call arms showing more recombination, in particular crossover events, than the centers of the chromosomes. But this is not connected to the presence of centromeres, as for example in Drosophila, and we still don't understand why this is so from a mechanistic point of view. Now, we've established C. elegans for experimental evolution. It's one of the models, recent models for experimental evolution. We've just published a review in genetics about using Cynorhabditis as models for experimental evolution. So I'll refer you to that paper. What we did was to, in our lab, what we did was to mix 16 wild isolates, which presumably were highly inbred at the beginning and isogenic. We mixed them, we outcrossed them one with the other, with the goal of breaking up those wild isolate genomes while maintaining diversity, by maintaining them at high population sizes. And then for experimental evolution, we've gone through a phase of domestication to the lab conditions, and this is always going to be the life cycle employed in our experiments. In particular, we've used a 4-day discrete non-overlapping life cycle with constant larval to adult densities of 10 to the 4 individuals. And then for most of the phenotypes and fitness assays that we do, if not all, since we can freeze the worms, we compare both ancestral and derived populations in the so-called common garden assays to account for environmental effects. So what happened during the domestication to this lab environment? This shows essentially the demography. The male proportion is kept relatively constant since the beginning of imposing this life cycle in the lab, at about 20%, meaning that they outcross on average 40%. So it's twice the male frequency. And we have done plenty of work, in particular in collaboration with Christian Brandl and Patrick Phillips, who was here last week, to try and understand the life history of these populations, and in particular to try and explain why we can maintain both males and hermaphrodites at intermediate frequencies. Here just shows an example that when hermaphrodites are selfed, they show an adaptive response towards early life investment in fertility, but not when the same hermaphrodites are outcrossed. Okay, and we have similar data for the males. Excuse me? This in particular, we take together with the ancestral state, so that there is no environmental variation that could confound this. We place hermaphrodites, we let them self, and just measure the number of embryos laid throughout the reproductive period, and then this is early life. It's until day four, until they actually reproduce during experimental evolution. And the error bars over here, it's the means among the five populations, independent replicates, evolutionary realizations. So we've genotyped in these populations about 350 SNPs across two chromosomes for a total of more than 200,000 genotypes across time, four time points. And by genotype, I mean that we take individuals and genotype them. And here, it's just an example of, in empty bars, of the expected allele frequency change just by drift between generation 100 and the ancestral state in white bars. And then in gray bars, it's the actual observed differentiation. And you can see that it's quite different. We have about 40% of the SNPs that we observed significantly differentiated from the ancestral state, but only about 4% of them we find that there was extinction slash fixation. If we calculate a selection coefficient, assuming independence among all of these SNPs, we get these sorts of distributions, which is not particularly surprising. It's basically scales as the inverse of the effective population size, which we've calculated as around 1,000. So one order of magnitude lower than the census population size. More interestingly, what we find, since we have individual genotypes, we can quantify the individual heterozygosity. And we find that from an ancestral state of incredibly low heterozygosity, we very quickly maintain more heterozygosity than actually expected under a model of a neutral model. And this is important to note, that we obtain these credible intervals by numerically simulating explicitly not only the demography, meaning the population sizes and the frequency of males and hermaphrodites, but also the expected genetic distances between the SNPs that we've observed. Okay, so in a sense, we take into account the expected linkages equilibrium that is in these populations. So to explain this, we did essentially the same thing, but under several different selection models. And one of them, the one that gave the best fit, which is shown over here, this is just the result of the distance that when we simulate with a particular selection model, we compare them to the observed metric that we were following, and red means that the data, the model fits very well with the data, and otherwise the other colors. And in this particular one, we modeled overdominant selection as represented over here. Basically, it's just a coefficient that. Over here, this alpha that says how much, how strong it is, selection on these heterozygous individuals, and then a power parameter, which has been interpreted as telling you something about dominance and epistasis. In particular, if this k is 1, you have an additive model. If it's less than 1, you have sort of diminishing returns epistasis with the level of heterozygosity. And if k is above 1, you have this so-called positive epistasis. We've tested the alternative model, which is so-called associative overdominance. Simply, it means that there are deleterious alleles in this classical fashion, where x over here is homozygote genotypes, and over here it's heterozygotes. And although we can fit at the beginning of domestication this model quite well, afterwards we cannot fit. So the conclusion over here is not only that there must be some sort of true balancing selection occurring at some loci at least, and that these loci are actually epistatic with one another. Okay. Interestingly, so we've derived inbred lines from these populations after laboratory domestication, and this is a representation. And we've sequenced, whole genome sequenced, these lines. This is a representation of those sequences. Each row over here is one of these lines, or a partial. It's a partial set of those lines. And what I want you to notice over here is that we can infer, essentially, where each region came from relative to the parental wild isolates, because we know which wild isolates we put into this hybrid cross, and we can infer back these haplotype blocks, which are shown over here by these different colors. As you can see, this axis over here is expected genetic distance that we have. So it's not measured. It's from other work by Matt Rockman. And as you can see, you know, there is a lot of heterogeneity in these blocks.
Sorry, okay. What is the x-axis on this square plot?
Genetic distance, F2 map distance, linkage.
It's the chromosome position.
Okay. Right. It's yeah. Chromosome.
Yeah. But relative to the expected, number of crossover events.
There's a lot of heterogeneity. There's a lot of heterogeneity along the chromosomes as to where they got shuffled and who they picked up. But what's that region in the center that is all from one parent?
So, put it another way, we expect the same number of recombinants occurring between here and here, than between here and here. Okay, and we do not have a fit, a linear fit, with the size of the haplotype blocks. Okay, that's all I want to say.
And you mentioned something related to this earlier, where we can't attribute this to centrosomes, so we don't know.
No, we don't know why this is.
But her point was that it looks like there's also selection, right?
Yeah. So that's sort of the interpretation that we would like, but we cannot be explicit about it, at least at this point. So the other thing is that if you measure just linkage disequilibrium over here, so this is the actual distribution of haplotype sizes. And if we measure linkage disequilibrium, you'll see that on average, about at 1 centimorgan, we are going to background level. Okay. Which is quite low. And this plot over here, it shows that even though linkage disequilibrium between SNPs across two different chromosomes is very low, as expected, because there is segregation by definition every generation, we do find that using permutations, we do find that the observed interchromosomal linkage disequilibrium is higher than expected. Okay, so this is interesting. More interesting, perhaps, is that we've mapped two fitness components that, in other work, we have shown that have responded with some directionality during the domestication to the lab environment in a subset of these recombinant inbred lines. And this complicated plot shows to tell you that we do not find, when we do a single SNP or a single haplotype mapping, we do not find any effects. Okay, but we do find when we do 2x2. Okay, and since these are presumably inbred and isogenic, this we call additive by additive epistasis. And that's what's shown over here in these arches, these lines. You'll notice that some of them are between chromosomes, okay? And I don't remember exactly the numbers, but these interactions can account for like almost 30% of the phenotypic variation. So that's quite a large proportion. These small circles over here show a similar thing. It's a statistical technique that we used just to ask whether or not a given allele at a given position interacts or might interact with other positions across the genome, and that's what's shown over here by these branches. If we look, for example, over here, we can see that these instances of epistasis are similar to what Joaquin was describing. So there is sign epistasis, meaning that these, so here it's represented the two alleles of one locus, and here the two alleles of the other locus. So if you see a crossing like this, it's a magnitude slash sign epistasis. And so, I don't know, it might be related not only to what Joaquin was discussing, but especially to what Christian and Tony were discussing in terms of the so-called polygenic model. Okay, so it's unclear to me. These are fitness components, so by definition, you expect overdominance in fitness. This phenotype fitness mapping creates this overdominance. It's not clear to me that this is what you expect. I suppose so, right? On the effects themselves? I don't know. That's something that we can discuss. And one last bit is that, you know, despite all the complexities of the genetics, like this one, we must also not forget that even in perfectly constant environments, you have phenomena that we cannot still interpret, such as frequency dependence. This just shows that two genotypes taken out of a lab-domesticated population show frequency dependence. In particular, they show that one or the other is invading the alternative population with the alternative genotype. We do get consistent measures as predicted by Aldane. But when we compete these two genotypes head to head at intermediate frequencies, not only the selection coefficient is not the same as this one, it changes, it reverts in sign. Okay, and we cannot explain this. And we don't know how general this is. But one of the consequences, which I find that it has not been yet much discussed over here, is that this will lead to not only maintenance of polymorphism, obviously, but depending on the optimum, it might lead to actually more extinctions and or fixations than expected under a purely linear model. Okay, so that's the presentation of the model system. So how do we understand the population genetics and adaptation to changing environments, and in particular, what empirical data do we have? So I kind of could only find these two references, one by Ben Kerr's group and another one by Arjen de Visser's group, in which essentially they show that if you adapt asexual microbes to different rates of environmental change, in this case it's an antibiotic, you have, not unexpectedly, way more extinctions if the environmental change is very sudden than if it's gradual. But more importantly, you have that adaptation might be compromised the more gradual, the slower the rate of environmental change. And they've explained them, these dynamics, essentially based on the order of mutation accumulation and epistasis, as we were discussing in the last session. And so basically what we can learn from this is that not only adaptation and natural selection is contingent upon the order of mutation accumulation, but also it's conditioned on how much time you have to explore these fitness landscapes. Okay. Now, I would argue that most organisms, and even microbial organisms in nature, do not evolve, at least in the short term, by mutation accumulation. So we need another kind of model to do that. And most evolution, at least in the short term, actually comes from the sorting of pre-existing variants in the population. Okay? And this idea might be very simple, but the truth is that I don't think many people have paid attention to this. We can think that fitness, of fitness of different genotypes, shown over here by these colors, as a function of the environmental value. Here, this black thick line shows the mean fitness, and assuming density independence, frequency independence, no environmental effects, you can see that if the population survives to the environmental change, to a sudden environmental change, this gray genotype will be selected, and mean fitness very quickly, mean fitness of the population will, in this case, it will be more or less the same. Okay, but we will say that this will be the one that that will determine population genetic dynamic and adaptation. On the other hand, if we have a gradual environmental change, we'll have first the red genotype being selected, then the blue, and only finally the gray one. What are the consequences of this? There are several potential consequences. Since all populations are finite, genetic drift might actually lead to the loss during this period of the best genotypes, the slower the environmental change. But also adaptation can be compromised because more polymorphisms might be maintained than expected. Okay? And this will decrease mean population fitness and selection responses. So we've decided to sort of test these ideas doing experimental evolution. Now here it's from the lab domesticated population that we now know exactly what the environment or we can infer what the environmental regimes are doing to our populations. And we've genetically manipulated them so that they do not have males around, meaning that effectively we have just genotypes competing among themselves without much segregation or recombination between them. Okay? So it's simply a competition experiment. And what we did, we have three regimes. One, which we call the sudden, it's a sudden change to high salt concentrations. Another one is a gradual change up until generation 35, and then we keep it at high salt, and a control one, which are the conditions of the lab domestication. And here I want to tell you a story on the population genetics. We've measured, again, individual genotypes at these different time points across the whole genome this time, because of constraints, but also because of design that I can discuss with you. Each individual was only genotyped at a third of the genome, okay? And this is just the density of the SNPs that we've genotyped according to physical distance or expected genetic distance. And just to show you that for all chromosomes, we are able to have a very good sampling for distances below 1 centimorgan or 1 kb. And so these are some of the results. For chromosome 1 and 2, the points over here show the observed dynamic of what we call haplotypes, because because individuals only self, we can actually infer the haplotypes for each one of them, essentially by ignoring heterozygotes. And we clump them together in one class, which we call minor haplotypes. And under all regimes, all of them basically go to extinction, with the exception of two haplotypes, 1 and 2, in which in the sudden, over here, haplotype 1 rapidly goes into effectively fixation, while in the gradual one, we have another one that goes up initially, which is the same haplotype as in the control populations, but when the gradual populations hit high salt, you start to have a reversion in frequency. Okay. Now, this, never mind. So these are the dynamics. These lines over here are essentially a model that we fitted for each of these regions in order to identify not only the lineages that we have competing, but also their frequency. Okay.
I have still a problem. Like you call minor haplotypes and major haplotypes. And for instance, my expectation would be that they should be all minor anyway, because they are.
So that's what's shown over here. Actually, so this is the distribution of the haplotypes. So you do have just a few. This is the identity, and this is the frequency. Okay, and you only have a few at high frequency, and then a long tail of minor frequency haplotypes, okay? Which is, I believe, the expected distribution. So, since the genome is divided in three, we essentially estimated these fitness reaction arms, so the intercept and the slope of fitness relative to the environmental value, and then we clump them together to say something about the lineage. Okay, and it's a fully deterministic model, and that's why when we calculate the expected population dynamics, we have very nice curves over here. In the sudden, we have this particular lineage going into fixation within a time span of about 70 generations. We have the gradual populations. We have another lineage which first starts to increase in frequency but then goes down and then should be overtaken by the same exact lineage as we find in the sudden. So the line shows the medium of these of simulations or of these calculations, and these bars over here show the, even though the model is fully deterministic, we still need to sample the ancestral population. So we might have different haplotypes sampling coming to calculate these dynamics.
Does it show that these two haplotypes are competing with each other, right?
This is expected. So this is observed. Everybody's competing with everybody. But I'll go back just now to that. So since we sequenced a whole bunch of lines that I've shown you before, we can actually go back to those lines and identify the identity of the lines relative to the inferred identity over here of the model. We were lucky to do that, and essentially to test, I believe, what you are asking, we did try to figure out whether or not our interpretation of natural selection in changing environments, which basically is just these fitness reaction norms, is true. This is the predicted fitness reaction norms for these two lineages, which we call gradual and sudden lineages. So we went up, revived these inbred lines, and did just calculated under the conditions that we've imposed during experimental evolution, demographic conditions. We just measured the growth rate of these lineages, the blue and the red, as well as the population with a whole bunch of different lineages together. And indeed, at intermediate NACL concentrations, as predicted, we do have the crossing of these fitness reaction norms. Okay, you can calculate the relative selection advantage of this lineage towards this one, or the other way around, which would get to your question. And these are just as the log odds ratio of these two values. And this is the value that we get. Again, at zero, we have this this crossing at this concentration of an ACL, and to more directly account for in local competition, we did head-to-head competitions among these two and confirmed that in general we have the same selection coefficient. Okay, so this, in a sense, just demonstrates that we do have genetic variants for fitness, G by E fitness variants. Okay, and it's just an example of how can this go. More interestingly, so we've just shown this, but more interesting are the potential consequences of having adaptation occurring under these circumstances. And so the first, one of the first things is, okay, we predicted that this particular lineage would go to fixation. Is this true if we just let the experiment run for longer? That's the first prediction. The second prediction is that you can have these effects due to genetic drift or the maintaining maintenance of polymorphism under slower rates of environmental change that can compromise somehow the ability that these genotypes will be selected. Okay, so this one over here, the one that we find that it's the best in high salt. And so for that, we went back to the freezer and rerun the experiment with seven populations that underwent gradual evolution until generation 35. We've revived them, all of them, so everything over here before is independent between these. And we just asked the question, or two questions. One is there any difference in the population genetic dynamics of this particular high-fit genotype? Is it dependent on the ancestral state? And the other one is that we've asked, we did two regimes, one in which we call large population sizes, which is this 10 to the 4 population sizes, and three replicate populations in what we call small, it's just 2 times 10 to the 3 census population sizes, and we just asked, what do we see?
The founder was always the same, basically.
Yeah, that's the point. It's the same at generation zero, but then it went gradual.
At generation zero, it's the same.
Yeah. So we're just looking at differences generated during these 35 generations of adaptation to a gradually changing environment. And so this is a complicated graph. We did pool genotyping at the ancestral, after 15 generations in high salt, and after 30 generations in high salt. And basically, we went for SNPs that we know would identify this particular lineage, okay? And then just using a distance between the allele frequency changes at these different time points, we can pinpoint with a lot of confidence whether or not the focal lineage, which is this red dot over here, swept through the population or not. And these are some of the results. For the first ancestral population and the second, it's clear that high population sizes, which is this green, which are these green arrows, are the ones that eventually, within a period of 30 generations, have effective fixation of the lineage that we were looking for. Small population sizes, in this case, they don't get there, so they might have lost before or during the freezing in the freezer, they might have lost this haplotype. This ancestral over here shows that we don't have differences between large and small population sizes, which means that basically the initial frequency of this lineage was high enough so that population sizes are not an issue. The next three ancestors, we have a very different response. None have shown sweeps of this particular lineage. In two of them, they actually show a sweep of something else, which we cannot identify, but we presume that it's another lineage. So this very clearly shows that slow rates of prior slow rates of environmental change, plus the freezer, have led to the loss of this best haplotype. And here, this ancestor, we don't know what's happening, but certainly they've lost as well the best high salt genotype. And then in the last two ancestors, we have a different pattern in which, in a subset of the populations, and in particular only in the small populations, do we find a sweep of this lineage. Okay? We interpret this as the maintenance of diversity, actually. So according to just standard population genetics, if you maintain similarly fit genotypes during this phase of gradual environmental change, then you predict that mean fitness will go down, and the small populations, because of drift, have lost possibly these other haplotypes that are as fit as the one that we're looking for. Okay, so that's the interpretation, even though we have not shown it or validated this idea. Okay, so that was mostly what I had to say about evolution in changing environments. We're doing a lot of phenotypic analysis in these populations, which should tell us a little bit about this mapping between genotype, phenotype, and fitness. And now I'll change gears to talk a little bit about natural selection in temporally fluctuating environments. And this is just a plot that we might have climate change, that it's sort of a gradual thing that is happening, but also the frequency of extreme events, which you can interpret as fluctuations in the environment, is also increasing. So I would say that it's actually important to understand natural selection in this context. And theory, suggests that when individuals have information during development about the environment that they will face at the time of reproduction, then what underlies selection will act so that phenotypic plasticity, whatever the phenotype is involved in generating fitness differences, underlies adaptation. Okay. Now, one interesting question is that in a lot of natural conditions, individuals do not have information about the environment that they will face when they are reproducing. And this information can only be given essentially by the mother or by the parents. Okay? And so we were interested in trying to understand whether, if you assume that there is no opportunity for the evolution of phenotypic plasticity, what are the conditions, how does natural selection work to lead to the evolution of maternal effects and as a consequence to adaptation to fluctuating environments. So what we did, mostly Steve, was to go back to the board and try to first understand how selection in fluctuating environments acts on what we call maternally independent effects. These are just when the offspring phenotypes do not depend in any fashion on the maternal environment / phenotype. And if we consider two different phenotypes in two discrete environments, then because the environment is fluctuating, the genotype that will win is eventually the one that has higher geometric mean fitness across all the possible environmental regimes that it has faced during its history, which is given by this expression. And the parameters over here for one particular genotype is simply the frequency, this alpha, the frequency of environment 1 versus environment 2. And then these two over here, which are explicitly modeled, are the fecundity and the survivorship. Okay, this allows us to actually model trade-offs between these two fitness components. Okay? And you can ask, in the environment all possible environmental regimes, which are represented over here in these two axes. This just shows the probability of environmental change from environment 1 to environment 2 and the other way around. You can simply ask when what are the conditions that allow one genotype to, or one phenotype to win over the other one. This curve is what defines this over here, right? This inequality over here. So in terms of interpretation of the environment, so here the environment is mostly constant on 2, okay? It's basically always on 2. Here it's has equal frequency of both environments, and it's basically always changing. Here it's the other way around. And over here, on this negative diagonal, it's when basically there is no information between maternal and offspring generations about the environment. Okay. There is no correlation between the two. And so we can get these expressions, and now we can start to ask questions about maternal effects. We call deterministic maternal effects those where when offspring phenotypes depend on the maternal environment in a consistent manner, okay, for lack of better words. Okay. Now, the fitness of such a phenotype is, besides these other parameters, is also a function on this probability of environmental change. Okay. We actually have two kinds of maternal effects, one which we call alternating, since the mother has, or the offspring has, the alternative phenotype to the mother, and one which is maintaining, which is when the mother and offspring have the same phenotype. And then we can compare essentially what's the relative fitness of such a strategy, of such a maternal effect, relative to not having maternal effects. It's just asking this question, and this is when we have higher fitness for these strategies relative to the just having the pure genetic offspring only phenotype. Okay. We can ask exactly the same question about a different kind of maternal effect, which we call randomizing maternal effects. Mothers randomize offspring phenotypes, but the probability of a given phenotype does not depend on the maternal environment. In the literature, this is usually called bed hedging or risk spreading kind of effect. We can and right now we have an extra parameter that just says, just quantifies the probability of producing one of the phenotypes, and we have this strategy winning the genetic strategy over at this space. And when we compare the actual relative fitness difference between these two, it's obvious in this 3D plot over here that the deterministic maternal effects actually have a selective advantage relative to the randomizing ones, way larger than I guess expected a priori. So this is the summary slide. We include over here the more realistic case in where you somehow randomize your offspring phenotypes based on your environment, which is what most organisms probably do. And this one is an all-encompassing strategy, but evolutionarily, selection basically, or this strategy basically collapses into one of these two, so deterministic or randomizing, except for a very small part of the environmental regimes. Okay. Okay, so that's for the theory that we've developed, and we wanted, it actually did not work that way, but it works over here for the purpose of the talk. We wanted to test a little bit this, because in the literature in particular, there was a lot of discussion or interpretation that a lot of the things that you observe are, in terms of maternal effects, are due, to, for example, to bed hedging, and that's actually not shown. So what kind of maternal effects we have in C. elegans? We were motivated by this paper by Frazier and Ross, in which they've shown that worms of an inbred standard lab strain, when hermaphrodites are challenged with high NaCl concentrations, then their offspring have problems surviving anoxia. Okay? And we've shown this in our populations as well. And further, they've shown that basically this trade-off, transgenerational trade-off, is due that to a metabolic trade-off in that the mothers, the hermaphrodites, need to essentially accumulate glycerol to survive the osmotic stress imposed by salt, and they are not good enough at putting enough glycogen into their babies, which is essential for anoxia survival. Okay, so it's a very clear and well-defined trade-off, which basically the question was, can we see the evolution can we break apart this trade-off or not?
So does that mean that you can rescue this transgenerational effect by supplying the embryos with more glycogen?
That has not been shown, and I suspect, I'm not even sure how you would do it, but yes, it has been shown with like mutants and of these pathways. And so we've had the high salt adapted populations that I've shown you in the first part. That's actually why they were first generated, was to do this particular experiment. And this is the fitness response of after 35 generations, I think, and their gradual change. In high salt, low salt, fitness response relative to the zero, the ancestral. So there is adaptation, or there was adaptation, to high salt environments. And we've conducted a lot of phenotypic analysis, both at the metabolome and transcriptome level, in which we were able to show that indeed the evolutionary response over here of these populations is to start essentially producing way more glycerol, among many other things, okay? Which is what this cartoon attempts to show. So we had the perfect situation to now ask the question, what happens if we challenge these populations with fluctuating anoxia all the time, okay? Not with fluctuating anoxia, not with high salt. They are always in high salt, and we're just asking the question about fluctuations in anoxia. And so under a two-generation life cycle, fitness can be defined by essentially the productivity of a fixed number of embryos that we put in the maternal generation relative to the number of larvae that come up in the following generation. And the fitness components are two, what we call fecundity, which is simply the number of embryos in the first maternal generation, and then the hatchability, which is the relative survivorship between embryos and larvae. And this is important because a maternal effect is supposed to change the hatchability, and only as a correlated response, the fecundity of the mothers, okay, if anything. And so this is the ancestral state of the population. We indeed, this is scaled over here in the maternal. These are assays in which we measured growth rates from here to here, okay, so fitness. under the several combinations of maternal and offspring environments. And we indeed, whenever the offspring are in anoxia, we have a huge decrease in their viability, or in the population growth rate, and that this decrease is due to hatchability problems. Okay, it's not due to fecundity problems of the mothers. Okay, it's not that they lay less eggs, depending on where they've grown. And so, to test this, to understand natural selection on these conditions, what we did was essentially to devise two regimes, one over here that mimic these environmental transitions, which we call predictable. It's basically alternating between normoxia, high salt, and anoxia, high salt, again, every other generation for 60 generations. And then over here, a constant regime, which for 30 generations, they faced anoxia, and then they were switched back to normoxia, such that the probabilities of transition across these 60 generations are these. In both regimes, we have 50-50 numbers of anoxia and normoxia generations. And so, and it's replicated fourfold in terms of independent populations. And so here I'm showing you assays, again in the same format, relative to the ancestral states that I've shown you previously. So here means that they are growing better. Negative values means that they are growing worse. And a lot of things happen over here. The most important one is that when the mothers face normoxia and their offspring anoxia, there is a fitness increase, while when both mothers and offspring face anoxia, there is a fitness decrease. Okay. This one is normoxia that has increased. Now, adaptation can be, as a result of natural selection, can be interpreted in this regime only if you calculate the geometric mean fitness about for the environment that these populations faced, which is normoxia anoxia and anoxia normoxia. And if we do that, we do see that there is an increase, okay, relative to so they've adapted to this alternating environment. How have they done this? We've measured fecundity and hatchability. Indeed, over here, when the mothers face normoxia and their offspring anoxia, we see an increase. We also see a general increase, but a significant increase in normoxia and normoxia. But remember that these populations did not face this environmental transition. So this is a correlated response to this. And then interestingly, we find that there was a decrease in fecundity, meaning that adaptation occurred by the evolution of a maternal effect, deterministic maternal effect, at the expense of the moms. Okay? So even if the moms at a given generation, it's deleterious, this thing evolved, okay? This maternal effect. And we went on to actually demonstrate the physiology of this, and we were able to show that, or to find that only when the mothers face normoxia, so their offspring will face anoxia, they have indeed increased glycogen content. So that's it. So in the constant, as a control, we find evolution or increased fitness in these environments, so they've adapted to their environment after 30 generations only, so 30 generations of anoxia. But they've also perform well under when the mothers are in normoxia, which means that in principle this is just a maternal independent effect that has evolved. We have evolution of fecundity. We don't have anything in hatchability. It's basically the moms just put more embryos out and just hope that some of them will survive. That's how adaptation occurred. And so we've shown that adaptation to predictably alternating environments can occur by the evolution of these maternal effects. But the question remains on how is evolution occurring in uncorrelated environments? So we also did such a regime. We were expecting to see the evolution of these randomizing maternal effect strategies, so bed hedging, maternal bed hedging. And we have, because these are uncorrelated environments, there are many different possibilities of of designing these environmental sequences across these 60 generations. We did four for what I'm showing you now, and each replicated three times, I believe. And so here, it's exactly the same thing. When we measure the fitness response relative to zero, we do find, at least under anoxia-anoxia, a decrease in fitness when you calculate the geometric mean fitness across all the possible transitions, so all of these. We don't find anything, but if we find something, is a decrease. Okay? This demonstrates that bad edging has not evolved. Okay? It's impossible. But more interestingly, but we don't know why this. Okay, and if this is true, a decrease in fitness, how come? I mean, it does not make sense for populations to go down in fitness. We did measure fecundity responses and hatchability responses, all negative. Okay. And during experimental evolution, we never had problems maintaining populations. So population sizes absolute growth rate, were never an issue. Okay, so how do we explain this? We don't know exactly. Oh, and we've shown using numerical simulations, assuming the fitness differences among all of these environments, that if we have one allele with these fitness effect differences, and there are particular environmental sequences, we would have the fixation by the generation, or almost fixation by generation 60 of such an allele. So we don't know exactly what's going on. And this is the last part, just 5 minutes. So this begs the question, is that we define these environments only in terms of maternal offspring correlations, but any environment has some degree of correlation if you go back a few more generations, okay? Which is shown over here of the experimental sequences, even though we manipulated quite well the maternal. We've designed them to have basically zero maternal offspring correlation. If you go further back in time, there is some degree of correlation. So, and this is an alternative representation of these autocorrelations. It's just a spectral decomposition of the environmental fluctuations that we have. There is something in the environment that could provide information to the individual such that they would select for transgenerational effects of higher order than maternal effects. Okay, so there's that possibility. This, however, is somehow confounded by what can actually the organisms perceive from their environment, and we get to questions about what is a proper cue, okay? And that's what we're trying to understand. We did all of these experiments in these uncorrelated, what we call uncorrelated environmental sequences. We have six different kinds. We did under two regimes. One which we call the reliable regime, where we give them the worms' light during oogenesis, and in a reliable fashion, so meaning that whenever the offspring will face anoxia, the mothers are giving a light cue, and then we have an unreliable regime when the mothers are just duped into
sham.
Yeah. So there is no correlation between the light and the offspring environment. Okay. And so some results during experimental evolution about the population dynamics. So we've measured these growth rates. So it's just counting the larvae every generation. During experimental evolution, and they have a given pattern. More important, or more significantly, when in these curves we calculate the geometric mean fitness, whenever there are these three-generation transitions for these. So anoxia, normoxia, anoxia. So anoxia grandmother, normoxia mother, anoxia offspring. And we take the difference between reliable and unreliable populations. We do find some sort of correlation between how much better the reliable ones are relative to the grandparental environmental correlation, okay? And specifically under these transition three-generation sequences. Now, each data point over here is the sort of the average difference of six different populations. So there are 18 different independent replicates that go into this. So it's I believe that it's quite powerful, but we're still trying to understand how this works.
Have you tried to just between the just not transgenerational, just like a cross generation, mother and offspring?
Yeah.
But this is a skipping a generation, right? So you would expect this.
It's not skipping because it's the geometric mean fitness. So by definition, it takes into account whatever happens to the maternal generation, right? In this case, it's just that we were looking for a maternal effect of normoxia and anoxia generation. It's just an example. So we don't know how to interpret this. More to the point, we did these common garden assays, but now we're considering three generations. So these assays are huge, with Q and without Q, given to the mothers, okay, in all possible combinations. And these are some preliminary results for only two environmental sequences, okay? We have six in total. And here, when the light cue is given, if the population, the evolutionary response, we find a whole bunch of different things, but it's clearly different between the two regimes when we have three generations in a row of anoxia, okay? Which is really not what we were expecting. But so we were expecting perhaps over here that they would be different in these two bars. They do not appear to be so. And as a control, exactly the same assay, but when the light cue is absent, we do not find it, even though we do find perhaps similar evolutionary responses in these environmental sequences. Okay? This is only partial data, so we cannot calculate, for example, geometric mean fitnesses out of this, because we do not have the offspring in normoxia. Okay, so a lot of these things could be correlated to whatever happened when the offspring faced normoxia. But it's pretty cool that, you know, you do have a dependency on the light cue, evolutionary. There was something that evolved. And it's we believe that it's unrelated to glycogen content that has evolved because the light cue was reliable, okay, independently of the environmental sequences. Okay, so yeah, so that's about it. So that's my just I briefly talked a little bit about these questions. There's way more to talk about it and to understand. And this is the acknowledgement slide, so thank you.
So going back to these light things, I'm not sure I understand it. So when you provide light, then for the unreliable, the world involved under unreliable conditions, the fitness cost is higher when you provide the light.
Yeah.
Which is...
So we actually, so in the ancestor, just giving the light, it actually increases the growth rate of the population by increasing fecundity of the mom for some reason that we don't know.
By a relatively small amount.
Yeah, but still, it's yeah. So the physiological effect is to increase, for some reason, fecundity. So there is an evolutionary response over here, for sure, which is interesting, because it must trade off with something that these populations are doing. We have no idea what they are.
Yeah.
You say 9q absent. Now how can you have revival to 60?
Well, one thing is the evolutionary treatment.
Oh, evolutionary treatment.
Okay, so that we do these sequences and we provide light in a reliable fashion versus unreliable. Another thing is the evolutionary response that we measure, the presence of light given to the mother, which is light Q given for all of the population, reliable and unreliable, or we don't give the Q.
But this light is entirely unrelated to what has happened during the culture, yeah?
Precisely. The culture?
I mean, during the evolution, this whatever, how many generations?
No, here, they. So if they change to anoxia, the mothers are given a light cue in the reliable.
I thought this was across the entire
system. Yeah. And the number of events is exactly the same between unreliable and reliable. Okay? And that's a little bit the point, is that it's a weird cue that we a priori knew that the worms could see. This cue, at least. And we're basically trying to couple this unrelated cue with the physiological response of anoxia stress.
So may I ask this thing other way? This is the same experiment that you have done only one over the 60 generations. So,
yes.
So how would the absence of the light cue affect your interpretation of the previous results, because you don't have the light cue there?
Exactly.
So what
exactly.
is the impact of this?
So we essentially are with, so we didn't test this, we tested more or less this, okay. It's the for the growth rate, so we have anoxia-anoxia and amoxia-anoxia, and it's similar. We have way more populations in the other one. But the tendency over here, without Q, is to go down as well. So there is, yeah, it might, we have the same results in both. We have way more power in the, but it is true that the light is doing something in these populations. I don't know, maybe potentiating something.
Just so I make sure. So those two graphs use the same growth. Basically, when you say light Q given, light Q absent, you mean when you measure growth rate response. I see, I got it.
Yeah, and it's so exactly.
And that's why you're
the same
saying the light is heavy.
Lunchtime.